This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. We're going to crack straight on because I've got a lot of questions for today's guest. I've been a big fan of this guy. He's a brilliant actor, the wonderful Stephen McIntosh. You'll know him from shows like Luther, Criminal Justice. He's been in the Underworld movies, Lock, Stock, of course. I've got a few other very big shows that are personal to me. And of course, The Muppet Christmas Carol. I've got to ask him about that. This is the first of his two songs. This is from the film Cinderella at Liberty and its love theme. Love theme. It says by John Williams, but I don't know if it actually is. Our guest today, the wonderful Stephen McIntosh, maybe you can confirm whether that is actually John Williams.
I can tell you that the soundtrack says composed by John Williams.
Yeah.
There's some lyrics on the album as well, and those are by Paul Williams.
Is he related?
No, they're not, but Paul Williams has got a very distinctive voice. He was involved in the Bugsy Malone soundtrack. So lots of those voices, those adult singing voices that you hear on the Alan Parker film are Paul Williams.
Amazing. Yeah. Oh, I love the songs on that soundtrack.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's such me good. Too. Yeah. Me too.
The piece we just listened to, Cinderella Liberty, that's the longest I've ever heard a harmonica played without a break. I think ever.
Yeah.
I'm on like the sort of Stevie Wonder type harmonica. I don't know what they're called, those. Why did you pick that? Are you a fan of this piece of music or you love the film? I've not even heard of the film. I feel bad for saying.
I don't know it either, so really? Don't feel bad because I haven't got a clue what it's about. Because I'm a bit of a train spotter in music terms,
yeah.
And I like interesting old.
You were saying while that was on, you love soundtracks, yeah.
I think I read about this being a kind of renowned. Right. Soundtrack.
Yeah.
So I bought the album before I even knew what the film was. And it's one of those, and it's a classic 70s soundtrack. It's an up-tempo, jazzier, kind of upbeat version of that.
They don't do that as much anymore,
do they? No, I really, I love that as a thing. And then there's some lyrical bits on the album. I stuck it on last night as well, knowing we're going to possibly talk about it. It's a beauty. But I don't know the film.
Have you got a lot of soundtracks that you listen to, but you haven't watched the film?
I've got quite a few.
Have you?
There are some great funky ones.
Yeah, yeah. The sort of blaxploitation stuff.
I picked up one the other day. I was filming in Bristol and I picked up one. I found a funky soundtrack there called...
Like a is it vinyl shop?
It's on vinyl, and it was. I can't even remember the name of the film. It's called Cornbread and something, or other. I mean, it's
amazing.
But the music is by a funk band called the Blackbirds, who are a great.
Had you heard of them before?
Yeah, I mean, they're a sort of great funk outfit from the '70s. And this album is again, it's a blinder.
Yeah,
got the theme. It's got the kind of.
I bet some of
several versions of the theme, and then there's some funk workouts on it that are just. Second to none. Yeah.
Well, Stephen, thank you for joining us. I've been a big fan of your work for many years.
Oh,
you've
thank
actually,
you.
You've sort of weirdly made stuff that has kind of pinpointed eras of my life. And I don't want to like make you feel old all of a sudden, but you were a part of my childhood.
Okay, and then, I'm hearing that quite a few people have said that
really?
To me lately. It does make
but
me
then
feel incredibly old. What can I do? I've
you
been
started
around
young.
A while.
You started young.
I did.
I
know it's true. I did. I started. Yeah, I was
so
a nipper when I was doing it. And then.
I mean, you were probably only a couple of years older than me. I'm talking, of course, about Adrian Mole, which I loved that show so much as when I was a kid.
It was a big deal when it came out because, because the book
the
was
book,
such an enormous
hit.
And I was, I read the book like everybody else.
Right.
You know, when they were doing a TV adaptation of it, I just couldn't quite believe that I got the job. And it was an amazing.
How old
group
were you
of
when
people.
You got?
I was the first one. I think I was maybe 14.
Right.
And then the second one, I think, I was 15. We did the two books consecutively.
It was just two series.
It was just, because it was the Secret Diary of, and then the Growing Pains of. And then I think Sue Townsend left quite a big gap before she did some later books.
Like in his
20s. Stephen Mangan played him later on.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I presume it was one of your very first roles.
It was
I'd
done little bits before then, but that was a big deal because it was a book of the moment.
And it must have been a moment where suddenly you were being recognised. People saying, "Hey, you're not." Was it Nigel, wasn't it?
It was Nigel. I guess so. I suppose perhaps I wasn't as instantly. Adrian himself was such an iconic character and his look
and
his kind of, you know, the glasses.
Yeah.
I don't remember people kind of stopping me in the street. It's a long time. It's a long time ago now.
But I just think at that age, it must be a strange thing to suddenly be in something that people are talking about. Not everyone gets to do a show that has such an impact so early on.
Yeah, it was so exciting.
How did you get into acting then?
In a kind of amateur way, really. Yeah. It was amateur dramatics.
Yeah.
I was a bit of a slacker at school, if I'm honest.
Right.
I didn't get school. I didn't understand why you needed to pay attention. Drama was something that I really loved. And when I did it, people said, "Oh, he's good." And so I did more of it.
Finally, someone said something nice.
Yeah. So
I'm gonna run with that.
There seemed to be kind of a lot of negative stuff going on in, do you know what I mean? The school arena the feedback I got was generally quite negative. You know, it was that cycle of, well, they tell me I'm, don't listen, so I won't, you know, I'll carry on not listening.
Yeah, yeah. You sort and of
the,
almost
and the,
proved
and the reverse,
them right.
The reverse was going on in drama where people, you know, they laugh when I deliver a line and I don't know, things like sort of.
Were people from your family into acting or theatre?
My mum was involved behind the scenes.
Yeah.
think it was through her encouragement that I got involved. She loved to be involved. She didn't harbour any desires to be on the stage, yeah. but she liked to be involved backstage. We're helping with costumes and with yeah. so she was her thing and I yeah
so she was encouraging
that, and that was my way yeah. in, and I ended up getting my kind of first professional job when I was I think I was about 12. I did a play at the Bush when I was 12.
Wow. The Bush is in
Shepherd's Bush. I don't even it used to be yeah. above a pub, and I think it's moved now. It was right
there's
on
a lot
Bush
more
Green.
Of those sort of fringe off West End theatres back then, wasn't there?
There were lots of
I
those
I feel like there weren't
I know I feel
as
no
like loads above pubs
lots of I feel like yeah the pub venue is
thing of the past it,
it
feels,
does feel
it?
I mean I think even the Bush Theatre now is it from what I my sense of it there might be a kind of bigger more yeah. established looking venue, but it was a little tiny room
yeah.
above a pub
yeah, yeah.
that did some very edgy I mean, and this play was extremely edgy. It was about Aleister Crowley, who is a kind of dark cult figure from the 50s who mm. had a mysterious yeah cult I believe in France, and there was all sorts of communal stuff happening yeah. drugs and sex, and I was this 12 year old kid playing a child that was living in this commune while all this wild stuff was going
right.
on.
Did you understand the
I didn't
what
I
the play was
I
about
sort
really?
Of yeah I kind of I like, oh I see it's these weird people
probably didn't get it and thought oh this is nice a little gang of people together
everyone was so delightful to
yeah.
me. I got the sense that the subject was very dark,
yeah.
but everyone was so lovely and smiley and charming
yeah,
backstage.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of
weird,
yeah,
weird mix.
A weird mix of stuff.
And you're above a pub
yeah,
at 12.
Above a pub. And there was lots of, you know, there's lots of swearing and kind of simulated sex in this play. I mean, it was weird,
yeah.
but I loved it.
And you were
it.
Like, I'm home.
This is me. This is where I belong.
Sex, swearing, and communes.
Above
I found.
A pub,
I found. Yeah. I then, of course, just continue with this theme of you of the stuff that you did that had such a big impact. You then, obviously, you did stuff between them, but in my teens, or I think this was in my late teens. I didn't see it when it came out, but The Buddha of Suburbia, and we had Roger, the director, on recently, and that was another show that was just like absolutely blew me away. I think for very different reasons. That was one of those things where you're starting to really, as an adult, get what good writing's about
right.
and good directing
yeah.
and acting and stories, and that was one that I watched on VHS all in one evening. Me and my mate watched
wow.
it all in one evening, because this was pre-binge watching,
yes.
you know. It was like, quick, where's the next tape? You know, we actually had to swap bits of plastic around to see the next episode.
Brilliant.
That again, that must have been for you, because talking to Roger, he said that was a show that definitely felt like it made a bit of a noise when it came out, and because it was a little bit, again, a bit controversial with some of the themes and things.
Again, it felt very, very special. At the time...
That was a book as well before, right?
It was, yeah,
yeah.
It was a book. And yeah. I happened, it was just one of those, the timing was kind of incredible for me. At the time, I was doing a film with Hanif Qureshi
okay.
that he was directing in London.
Oh, wow.
I was doing a film called London Kills Me. And this was in,
we're
talking about the, wow, early 90s.
Yeah.
And so I was doing this film with Hanif. And at the time, I think I'd just read the book. And I'd seen this role and I was thinking... Okay,
yeah.
I'm gonna need to. Just,
I better be good in this film.
I need to try
yeah.
and make this happen.
Yeah,
and I think I remember having conversations with him on the set of this film we were doing, and hearing maybe that the BBC were going to do it, and I was like, "So, Hanif, they're going to be doing
what,
this." And
do you think I could look like
that's
him?
That's a great. That's a great.
Yeah.
I'd love to do that,
yeah. Yeah.
and I think there might have been the same casting directors on the two projects,
okay.
so it all just. I met with Roger and I...
Was it an audition process
yeah,
or did you just meet?
I met Roger
or?
And Red, I think,
yeah. Was it clear, because there was a lot of talk about it sort of being half based on Bowie, that character?
There was
like
I believe it's a kind of blend of Bowie and Billy Idol. I believe Charlie Hero in the book, he's not quite at Bowie's level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
he's not quite Bowie.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what makes him really interesting
yeah.
as well. He sort of, he kind of thinks he's better than he is.
Yeah. because I grew up in exactly where it's set, in Beckenham, Bromley way, and I think there was something quite inspirational about that character, because at one point he like moves to New York. Even as recent as the 90s, like, it still seemed like quite an amazing sort of otherworldly thing to do, to be able to move to America. And I think now we live in such a globalized world, but that character was like, wow, imagine being able to leave Beckenham and go and live in New York City.
Yes, it's like going to another planet.
Yeah. Where, you know, rock stars and artists
exactly.
live.
And I knew that stuff was in the book. And then when I saw the scripts, I thought, well, of course it's in the scripts as well. And now I thought, well, it's the BBC. We're going to shoot it in London somewhere, and it's going to double as New York.
There'll be a painting
and
of New York.
And then when
York
they
skyline.
Said, we're going to New York to shoot it, I was like, get out. Get the flip out. Yeah. We're going to go to New York, and I'm going to play a rock star
in New York,
yeah. who moves to New York in New York. And it was just...
And a period piece. You're in New York, and they're making it look like the 70s, was it? Like late 70s?
Yeah, I mean, so I did some stuff. This is a massive high point. Yeah. So I did some stuff. Naveen Andrews and I, Naveen who played Kareem,
yeah.
we did some scenes where we were walking around Greenwich Village, and I was wearing an electric blue fur coat with...
I didn't even know fur came in blue.
This coat was astonishing.
Yeah.
And it was so good. I had vertical hair and electric mm-hmm. blue coat. And we were doing scenes walking around Greenwich Village. And then we did another scene in a stretch limo around Times Square. It was like, I couldn't believe what I was up to. It was
and
so exciting.
Also, that means you would have seen New York pre-Giuliani days. So that was still a bit rough. And
it was a very different town then.
Because I went there in 97 and it had just started to be cleaned up and, you know,
my
sort of...
My first visit to New York, I think, was probably... I think I'd maybe made one visit before then.
Mm.
Maybe 1991 or something.
Yeah.
It was edgy.
Yeah.
I remember being quite unnerved by it.
And, like, Times Square was full of, like, porn cinemas and peep shows.
It was
and,
wild.
Yeah,
I remember staying the first time I went there. I stayed up in the area known as Hell's Kitchen. I remember hearing gunshots at night.
No. It's sort of exciting
and
as well.
It was like, and I remember walking down the streets in that part of town and thinking, I'm not that comfortable.
Yeah.
It was exciting, but at the same time, a little bit scary. And it was. And when we went back to shoot Buddha, it was still very much like that. And we stayed in a fantastic hotel called the Gramercy Park Hotel. It's not what it's fancy apartments.
Yeah.
But it was a kind of run-down, groovy, bohemian hotel where I think, you know, the Stones had stayed there. It's a bit like the Chelsea. It had that kind of decadent charm to it.
And did you see other like people from film and TV, or,
you know, there were lots of kind of model-y people there and bands in the bar? And
how old were you, by the way, when you were doing this? Because it sounds like that literally the time of your life.
Mid-20s.
Oh my god,
it was it was incredible. And I remember going to the Lower East Side then, and it was wild.
I went in 97 with me, and my friend for some reason said, because we'd done all the touristy stuff, let's go to Harlem. And we got on a bus and drove up like one of the main avenues, and each stop all the white people were getting off. And then it was like a film, like you see a shot of a bus. We got off and the bus pulls away and it's just us two, these two like 19-year-old, almost fluorescent white kids. It was like something from New Jack City or, you know, Boys in the Hood or something. And it was so, like, for us, so terrifying. And people were just looking at us like, what is, you know, and buildings had been burnt out and cars on fire. And so it was like proper gangland.
Yeah.
And someone said to me the other day, they were there the other year, sort of going to a posh coffee shop and penthouse apartment.
Unrecognizable.
I'm like,
I've been back to New York many times. We've got a very good friend who lives there. So it's been amazing seeing how it's changed. I don't think there's any area now where you would feel like that.
Yeah. Feels like the world has been gentrified, doesn't it, in a way? When the show went out, that must have been like a really exciting time as well, for like to see something really, from, you know, what I understand, it made headlines on the paper, because it was, I mean, it's probably actually, thinking about it, for you, you were a bit blasé because you started your career in a commune play with sex and drugs.
Oh,
and
just another.
Yeah, you're just like, oh, this again.
Give me something dull and boring to do.
Can I have something on Sunday afternoon, please?
Yeah, exactly.
You know. But it must have been pretty to see, and also just to see how it came out, how well it came out as well. Because that's the thing when you're acting, sometimes you just don't know, do you? But
you really don't know, especially when you film something and then you never quite know how. You can have an image in your head about what the kind of piece you think you're doing, and you know how it might come together, but you can never predict. What you think it'll be. And also, the other one is you can never, trying to predict audience reaction is like, well, forget that.
Yeah.
I've given up on that one.
Well, I do stand up. I've learned several times the hard way of like peeking through the curtain, looking at the audience and going, oh yeah, they're these types, and then always being wrong.
Yeah, completely.
Do you still find, having done as much work as you have, that you can be surprised by how a script turns out, liking a script and it not working out, or even turning something down because you didn't think the script was good, and then you see it on TV and you go, oh God, that was amazing.
I've had experiences both ways where I've had a script that I thought, this is going to be extraordinary because the script's extraordinary, and then the finished film or TV show is like, it just didn't quite gel. It's a really interesting thing because so many different things,
it's the alchemy,
have
isn't it?
To come together. It is like a stars aligning thing sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
A great script, it's probably going to make a... there's going to be something... if the script is good, there's going to be something interesting about the final, you know, about the final product.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not going to necessarily, you know what I mean, in a way that just all the elements come together.
Yeah, what is, there's a saying about, like, you can ruin a great script, but you can't make a bad script good, or something
like that. Well, exactly. It's like, if you've got the basis for something, like I said, you're going to make something of value out of it. Whether it's going to work fully is another matter. If you've got nothing to start with, well, you know, you can't make something
polish
out of nothing.
It. Is there something you've made that you feel is, a lesser-known thing in your canon of work that you're really proud of that you wish more people had seen?
There's lots of those. Yeah, do you know what? There are a few of those. Yeah. There are some films which I've absolutely loved and nowhere near enough people have seen.
Yeah.
It's smaller films, you know, low budget films, which have always, maybe that's changing now because maybe they can find their place on streaming services now. And so it's hard for certain small films to find an audience. I mean, there's a film that I did in 2005 called Small Engine Repair, which is a film I made in Ireland
Is it about a mechanic by any chance?
It's about some guys in rural Ireland that are kind of washed up and down on their luck. My character repaired lawn mowers and leaf blowers and Ian Glenn was my friend, and he was a forklift driver, but he had ambitions to become a country singer. It was a kind of low-key gem, I suppose. But I love this film, and everyone who saw it just fell in love with it. It was just that not enough people saw it.
Pitching that in this day and age, I just imagine people going, God, how do we...
Well, you know,
how do you get the money?
I'll be honest with you, I think that was the problem back then. Like, the pitch for it is not...
It's quite low concept.
It's like, how do you make it sexy? But if you see the film, you go, oh, I just love this.
I'm going to check this.
It's really worth checking out, because it's...
What was it called again?
It's called Small Engine Repair.
Small Engine Repair.
And he's a director called... I've done two of his films. He's an Irish writer-director called Niall Heary.
Okay.
And he has a...
What was the other film you did with him?
A film called Gold, which was a few years ago. Maisie Williams, who's in Game of Thrones, is in it, and that's about a kind of low key. He's brilliant,
like,
at this
sort of character driven
minor key.
Yeah,
the comedy is very gentle but beautiful.
Yeah,
they're like the equivalent of the classic American indie film, in a good way, without trying to sort of ape that style of, you know what I mean, without trying to copy that.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a very unique quality. So yes, there are a few things that I can mention which I
feel like you mentioned, like the comedy aspect of those films, that you don't do quite as much comedy or comedic roles as you used to.
It's true. And I'd like to do...
I was going to say, like, is that a conscious decision? Were you like...
No, not at all.
You wanted more awards or...
No. I love comedy. And Niall's films have got the comic touch.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I love them so much. Because I got to explore that more. I love comedy. But I think Possibly later on, I became a little more associated with some intense, dark roles, and then
quite a few like really good dramas on BBC and stuff, but very heavy stuff as well.
Heavy duty stuff. So then possibly people think,
oh, he's what he does.
He's not the go-to guy for a laugh.
And what I would say about a lot of your comedic performance, certainly the two shows I just mentioned and the film I'm going to talk about as well, which is that you play someone who takes themselves very seriously really well in a comedic way. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Because in The Buddha of Suburbia...
Which, exactly,
like,
he is that, exactly.
People that don't realise how ridiculous they are.
And that's what makes it so...
Because the other film that I felt like, as I was coming of a certain age, you did certain things that reflected that time in my life as well, was Lockstock, of course. And again, it was quite a pompous guy in a way, wasn't it? Don't you think?
Absolutely.
He had sort of delusions of grandeur.
Completely. Yeah. I think he's seeing himself as the kind of... It's a sort of kingpin within this world, but actually he's kind of ludicrous.
Can you remember the character's name? You were like the drug dealer, the weed grower. Yeah,
his name's Winston.
Winston, that's right. Was it written for someone like you, or did they go, oh, let's go? Because it could have been, you could have gone for a more gangstery type or a more, but he was a sort of public schoolboy.
Yeah, it was definitely written that way. It was definitely.
That wasn't like a later idea to
no,
sort of
Guy,
go.
No, Guy was after that contrast, which I think was really funny.
Yeah. And again, another thing that just had a pop culture moment that really like...
I was closely attached to that film for a couple of years while they were raising the money to make it.
Okay.
And I always loved it, and I was like, "Well, if they ever get to make that, I'd love to, because it's a funny." Mm-hmm. I knew it was funny, and you know, it had something about it. I mean, who could predict that kind of response?
Mental, wasn't it?
No, you can't. There was an extraordinary thing happened with that where I went to an early screening of it.
Mm.
And I'd been speaking to kind of Jason Fleming and Nick Moran and those guys, and they'd been saying, oh, it's really come together well, you know. I was like, okay, that sounds exciting. I remember sitting in the screening and that opening sequence where they're being chased with the dodgy, you know, with the moody goods in the bags. And a bag goes flying and there's a freeze frame and that, I think it's an ocean colour scene track kicks in.
Yeah. God, it feels like so mid-90s.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I know. Yeah. And I had a rush up my spine, a tingling sensation in that moment where I suddenly realised, this is a hit.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Even before it went out?
At that moment, I was like, this is what they call a hit.
Yeah.
I could feel it. It was...
That's amazing.
It was like, and I've never really experienced anything else quite like that, but it was like there was an energy that I just... It was something else.
Yeah. And you know the sign of something that's really popped is when then everything afterwards is copying the style.
Right.
Do you know
exactly
what I mean? You know, all the pale imitations that come. And what gets me is there are people that are putting money into projects afterwards going, oh, can it be more like Lockstock? And it happens in TV comedy. People always like, whatever's a hit. And then never hits, like the thing you're copying. It's like, how have they not learned?
That's always the problem, isn't it? When people try and go in the slipstream of a particular popular thing. Yeah. They always think, well, maybe if we make something in that realm, people will like... But what people never realise is the next phenomenon is always something completely different.
That no one was expecting. And so often with people that aren't necessarily big names, or certainly in TV comedy, but maybe less so in films, but there's just this surprise, like this out-of-nowhere thing that so often happens.
Yes. You know?
And they spend so much money trying to put all the pieces that they think will make it definitely work. We'll shoot it like Guy Ritchie. We'll get that name.
Well, that's
we'll
it.
It in and it's
that's
like,
it. Well, that's
and then it doesn't happen.
That's the formula, I guess, that Hollywood's been, you know, tried to make, isn't it? It's the, well, if I bring in that group of people, I should get the winning formula. But of course, it just doesn't.
Have you seen it at all recently? I haven't seen it in quite a long
time.
It's
one of those things that, you know, it crops up. If I'm channel surfing, it occasionally there seems to be phases when it's suddenly on a lot.
Yeah, on like ITV4
maybe
or something.
Maybe a Film 4 or something where so I always see they're doing a...
Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, London Live, there'll be a... Do you know what I mean? There'll be a...
Oh, my God. I found myself watching London's Burning. You remember that show?
Yes.
Yeah, the fireman's show. I'm properly getting into it, even though it's so slow and, like, you know, feels...
Wow.
It doesn't feel like... But it was all shot on film, like, from then, so it's dated really badly. But I'm like, what am I doing watching London? And then a bit of Bullseye, Jim Bowen. It's like this... You can watch some funny stuff if you channel hop.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, from your youth.
You sure can. I think I do remember it being on a while ago and sort of, oh, I think I'm going to stick with it until the end and go, because it just works.
Yeah.
It just...
Is there many things of your stuff that you would rewatch? If you caught it, you'd be like, oh, I'm going to
watch
this.
It's like, I'll give it a bit, if it pop, you know, I'd never get anything off the shelf and go, I think I'll revisit one of my...
Criminal justice. I'll do that.
Nothing else to do. It's a bit of me time.
And the family come in and just catch you watching your own show.
It is quite funny. And the funny ones are the sort of the TV repeats can be quite funny. Yeah. The old, you know, the sort of...
From a while back.
Yeah, and you're going, God, I'd completely forgotten about that one.
That's a sign of having been doing it for a while, when you forget stuff you've been in.
I suppose it is, But I'll stick with it for a bit and then go, no, switch over.
Was there ever a point where, I guess I've got like two questions. One is like, was there a point where you've got, I don't want to call you a child actor, because that for some reason has some weird...
Dodgy connotation.
But you acted as a child successfully and then you managed to do that thing that not many people do, which is then are taken seriously and have a brilliant career as an adult. Was there ever a couple of years where it was a bit...
Fortunately not.
And
I think it was because...
I mean, you still look about 32 or something, so...
I certainly don't feel for being 32. My back's
gone
now.
Oh, don't even get me started on ailments.
God, here we go.
I turned 40 and everything just started falling apart. First the right shoulder, then the left shoulder, my back, my stomach. I don't know what's going on.
It's never ending.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Anyway, so... I think with the child actor thing, I just think I didn't see, there was nothing too, I mean, I know the Adrian Mole thing was a big deal at the time, but it wasn't, I don't think it was such, perhaps because my role wasn't...
Your more supporting role.
Yeah. Perhaps, again, if I'd been right at the centre of it, could have been more tricky. Yeah. I don't know, but I think the key was that there was nothing that was so... high profile that it left me stuck with that.
Yeah, yeah. That you were
role.
Like pigeonholed so badly.
Yeah, so it was like, he's the guy from.
Yeah.
I was just like,
that's good.
I managed to side. Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was younger, there were. I mean, I knew people that were doing Grange Hill and things, and I.
My favourite show.
And I probably would have loved to have done that. I just didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
But it might not have served me quite as well, perhaps.
I think almost certainly, if you judge it by other people.
But, you know, it's just the way it worked. It was just the way I managed
to
just
stay. You were too good. You were too good for Granger.
I think I just stayed slightly enough below. I managed to keep working and yet stay enough below the radar so I could just gradually, steadily keep.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it seemed to just happen. There was a, you know, that transitional age, 16, 17, 18. And then I was just able to do some, there was some lovely theatre stuff came up at the age of
And was work always 18. The main thing? Like, because I sometimes regret that I spent most of my 20s partying and think, if I'd been a bit more serious or whatever.
No, I thought I was doing that as well.
So you were burning the candle, yeah?
Yes, yeah. Of course I was.
You must have had a great time when... going around the world doing all that stuff. But then you have a family, right?
Yes.
At what point did it go from that to that, and how much did that affect the work you do, and did it change the way you pick roles? Or
I think eventually, no, I mean, I just eventually, you know, the party stuff just had, you just got to rein that in when you've got little ones to take care of.
Because at some point you realise you can't pull off having a hangover on set.
There gets a point when it's not a good look.
Yeah.
And I literally realised when that moment was. And I
really?
Took it,
like a specific moment or a week or a...
I took it quite seriously and went, okay, we're not doing this anymore. I'm gonna be a grown up. And it was no kind of judgment on what anybody else is, you know, doing. But I just thought, no, that's it for me. I'm just gonna,
yeah.
I'm gonna, you know, just just concentrate on the work and get some early nights. Yeah. And that's the way I've been ever since.
Oh, my. Do you know what? I love nothing more than an early night.
Yeah, it's great.
That I just, the pendulum's swing from, like, you know, going out all the time to sort of being in my pyjamas by 8 p.m.
is
like, it just went, it happened almost over the course of a week or something.
And the only thing I do like seeing live music.
Yeah.
But I'm so middle-aged now, I get upset by the fact that they all go on at 9 o'clock. I'm like, I've got to go and stand in a flipping room.
And the floor's sticky.
Yes.
And can't you come and play at, you know, a nice little...
Exactly.
You know, theatre or...
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Do you still try and go and see shows or...?
I do still go to live music when I can. Because, I mean, where I live, there's a lot of great small... I love small venues.
You're in Camden, right?
I am. Yeah. And I love seeing bands in small.
Yeah,
you know,
me too.
Some, like,
I hate big. I hate the O2.
Yeah, I mean, I've
thing.
Seen some great stadium shows.
Yeah. But
Neil Young, when he came last, was very exciting. Don't
did
get
he,
me wrong.
He played the O2.
He did play the
Serious?
O2. Serious? Yeah.
Was he with Crazy Horse or?
He was
Solo?
With. He was with the. They're called the Promise of the. I think they're called the Promise of the New or the Promise of the Young. Oh, excuse me for getting the name wrong. It might be called the Promise
the
of
promise
the Young.
Promise of the Real, I'm being
Promise
told
of the Real, thank you.
From the
thank
Natalie
you. I
those.
Didn't want to get that wrong, but yet I was destined to. It was a brilliant show.
Was it?
Because they're so young.
Okay.
And Neil is not so young, but obviously he's incredible. But I loved the fact that he was so...
committed
excited
and,
by this young band, and the young band were so excited to be with Neil Young. Just made a
how
I don't
old
know,
is
was
Neil
something.
Natalie 71 he is. It's fucking amazing that he can be, because he's one of the few. I'm about to contradict myself, but he is one of those few older acts who still seem to surprise and shock when he releases stuff and got that energy of a young person. But I was on the way here literally listening to the new Robert Plant album that was out like last week or this week or something.
I saw a bit of him on Jules Holland.
And it was like, this is amazing. Like, really good. Like it could be...
Well, in the same way, he's not content to just...
He's not sort of plugging the same thing, is he?
No, exactly. He's like, no, let's not do that.
Yeah.
Let's.
I'm an older man now. I'll do it this way or I'll do it that way. But I was really surprised straight away, like the first track. Oh, this is really good. So, you know, I'd check that out. So you would like to do more comedy. I'd like to see you in more, or certainly more comedic stuff. I think that would be great. But I still love, do you obviously still enjoy doing the work on stuff that's a bit heavier and
I mean, it all comes down to it's all about the quality of the writing.
Yeah,
if you've got a good, I don't mind if it's funny, dark, whatever. If you know, if the writing's strong, you just want to get involved.
Yeah,
really.
Definitely. And have you got stuff that you're doing at the moment that you're excited about?
I just completed something that I'm very it was an interesting story.
Yeah.
Very lots of.
Is this a TV or a film?
It's for Channel 4. It's a it's a four-parter, a mini series, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
It's written by a writer called Jack Thorne.
A limited series, I think they call it in the States.
Is that what they call a limited series?
Yeah.
See, and so
Jack Thorne, what's he done? I know
he's done a lot of things.
Yeah,
he's properly brilliant.
Natalie,
I know recently he's known for the adaptation, the Harry Potter live.
Oh, the live guy,
which
oh
I gather is going to Broadway, and so
that's
and
a phenomenon. That,
I mean,
isn't
I
it?
he did all the brilliant This Is England TV adaptations.
Oh, man. Amazing.
I think he might be writing a
Skins,
Star Wars script.
Really?
I mean, he's very, very clever.
Yeah.
And I've been lucky enough to work on two things of his, a feature film that he did quite a few years ago called The Scouting Book for Boys.
Oh, yeah.
And this is it's a dark piece.
Is it?
And I don't know what the title's going to be yet, because I think it might change. So I won't say what the title's going to be, but it's about...
We've got something here saying that the show is called Kiri.
At the moment,
At the moment, yeah. but it could change.
May change.
Yeah.
But I've just finished shooting that in Bristol and Cardiff with a brilliant, lovely director called Eros Lynn and a lovely group of actors. And
yeah.
So and I look,
do you get
I look
do you still
to
get as excited about doing stuff when you love the script as yeah. you always have? Yeah.
If it's good, I think everyone gets excited. Yeah.
You still get that feeling on the first day of set, like, oh, you know, new world, new people, that sort of thing. Because that's the thing I think is so exciting about the world of filming, is like how you never stop meeting new people or like collaborating yeah. with someone.
Well, and also now, because I've been around for a while as well, there were a few people that I'd worked with before, yeah. but a long time ago. And so that's really lovely as well. And you go,
well, of course, you work with Roger a second time, right? So
yes.
in The Mother, which is a film that maybe is one of your films that you could put in the not enough people saw it. I feel like that may have...
It's a great...
It's a lovely film,
really,
that.
It's
yeah.
a really, really good film.
And was that about 10, 15 years apart from Bitter of Suburbia to that?
It probably was, actually. I think we're talking about maybe 2003 or something
yeah.
like that.
So did it feel different? Was it like, oh, hey, Roger, look at me now. I'm a proper grown-up, or like, what was the dynamic? Did it feel any different?
Felt fantastically yeah. familiar. He's a great director, and he's you know, it's always a pleasure to be on the set with him, and because Roger does great material, and
yeah.
so it's the same thing. Everybody's pleased to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
Hanif Qureshi, Roger Michel.
What more?
You know, everyone's like, yep. Let's.
You did. You did some of the Underworld movies as well.
Yes.
Did that suddenly open up a totally like? Did you do like the Comic Con things? Those kind
no,
of.
No, I've
worlds?
Never done
no.
any of that.
I've
never been asked to do any of that.
Because you didn't do tons of genre stuff, have you, really?
No.
And then
but I did
suddenly,
get a couple of those.
Yeah.
I got to dress up and bite some people. That
did
was
you?
Fun.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
What, like biting people? Or?
Well, just the whole thing.
Like
I mean, it was just
the dressing up bit.
All of it.
Really?
It was just well. The first in Underworld 2 was the second. It's the second film of the series.
Yeah.
I'm not in the first one, but I was playing.
But you're
a
in more than one, right?
I'm in two
yeah,
and
yeah.
three.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the first one that I was in Underworld Evolution, I'm kind of playing a kind of bizarre kind of Hugh Hefner kind of vampire character. He's quite strange.
Yeah. Wow, that's quite a part to get, isn't it? Hugh Hefner vampire.
Yeah.
Some might
that
say
one
that
of those...
Hugh Hefner was a vampire.
Yeah,
that, you know.
I mean, there was... Yeah, you know, that was one of those things where you put on the costume, you put in the fangs, and you walk onto this fantastic set.
Yeah.
That, because the second film, the first film had made... did really well,
yeah.
I think, on a relatively small budget.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd been, and so the second one was even more expensive. And
right.
the sets were just fantastic.
So were they mostly, like, in-camera sets? Were they weren't, like, green screen and
enormous,
there's a lot of, like, practical...
Enormous builds. It was shot
really?
In... The second one was shot in Vancouver. And the sets were just... mind-blowing,
really?
Huge,
yeah.
and just beautiful detail.
Yeah, I just imagine that. I think it was Gosling said that he just couldn't believe it when he walked onto the Blade Runner, because it's rarer and rarer to get stuff actually built that isn't,
I'm sure.
you know.
Yeah, of course.
And they built these three dimensions where you look out of a window and you see a building, and then they've built the stuff in the windows of the building across the street, you know, like they've gone to that sort of detail.
I love that. You
yeah.
see, that's another incredibly exciting thing. When you step onto a stage like
yeah.
that, and then you see the skill involved.
Yeah,
in,
the craftsmanship.
Yeah, you just go, look at what's got the detail
yeah.
here. You can't help but get excited.
Have you ever
that.
Written anything before?
I've written a short film.
Right. And did you have a moment where you did... You stepped on, or was the budget so small it was like?
It's never been made.
Really?
I may never make it. I may make it. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's not specific to a time, because you might need to do it pretty quickly if it's like topical.
Don't think it's. I'm racking my brains to see if there's anything that places it in a certain period. But I did write one for fun. I'd quite like to shoot it one day. Yeah, but I've never had a burning desire to direct. But I it would be fun to have a go.
Because I've written stuff and you get on set and you're like, wow, I just came up with this in my kitchen. And now there are like a group of 20 people working to make this thing, this room real.
Fantastic.
So it's such a weird, you know, people doing their craft and working for weeks to just something you flippantly wrote on a script, like kitchen is a bit, you know, ragged or something. And then all these, that's their those people's job for a few weeks to do that. It's such an incredible thing.
It is.
I can't wrap up the interview without also mentioning, and hate me for saying this, I'm sure, but the Muppet Christmas Carol.
No, why would I hate you?
Well, the thing is so many people who have come on this show and talked about Christmas movies cite that as one of their top, like, three or four. It's become a sort of classic.
Well, that's the weird thing is it's classic status. I've seen it bloom over the years. When it first came out, it was an enjoyable film.
Yeah.
But over the years, it's become part of the fabric of Christmas, which is just, how brilliant is that?
You must have loved showing that to were your kids young? Were they already born then? Well, like, I'm not sure. I don't know what it was like.
Actually, one of mine was maybe just was very young when I'd literally just made it. Yeah, so they loved it, and it's one of, you know, of course, lots of people mention it to me, and some people seem to. I'm sorry for me. It's like, why would you be sorry? It's the Muppets.
You hear stories about certain people, actors who like hate that they're known for certain. They want to be taken more like, oh, yeah, but what about my, you know, the performance that won me that, or, you know, but like the Muppets, it's like pop culture.
It was one of those things. It was like, I can't believe I'm in Pinewood's, no, Shepperton Studios doing a scene with Kermit.
Yeah.
I'm exchanging dialogue with Kermit and Michael Caine.
That is like a dream, isn't
it?
Like a surreal dream.
Yeah.
Is it like acting with people and the people are down below you? Like, do you have the tendency to want to sort of...
No, you're just in the scene. They're so good. You're just in the scene.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The set was mind-blowing because the set's all built to scale, but it's built high on a platform for everybody to be underneath. You're gobsmacked at what's gone into kind of getting you on the set. And there's so, you don't even, yeah, it's like you don't even, not even, you forget there's someone underneath there, you know, with the hand up Kermit's arse. It's just, you know,
was it Jim Henson or had he sadly passed by that point?
No, it was Steve Whitmore, I believe, for that film. And then Frank Oz.
He was there,
the voice,
yeah.
Frank Oz, who's a brilliant director in his own
amazing,
right.
Amazing, yeah.
He's the voice of Miss Piggy.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, I remember being a sort of a Christmas feast scene surrounded by dogs, chickens, horses, Miss Piggy on my left, I think Kermit on my right, singing a song and just thinking, where do I go?
And
from
did you
here?
Had you like
where
right,
I'm doomed. I'm done. Shoot me now.
Get me the drugs.
Yeah.
I need to just go off
it's over.
Yeah. Did you love the Muppets as a kid as well, or is it
Loved the Muppet Show.
So
loved the Muppet Show. And then again before that film came around because coincidentally, I'd been involved in something before that, another Henson project called The Storyteller, which was a series of fairy tales.
Yeah, I don't remember this one.
John Hurt was the storyteller.
Okay.
With some amazing makeup on. He was unrecognisable. With a puppet dog, and he would introduce these elaborate fairy tales, which were all done with Henson Muppet creatures, and they were elaborate and expensive, and they were brilliant. They were shot in Pinewood. I mean, some amazing people were involved. I think Anthony Minghella wrote the one that I was in, and Brian Henson directed that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think that's how the Muppet Christmas Carol
came
out. So
John Hurt was unrecognisable. He must have got to a point in his career where he was like, why do people just keep covering my face? What's going on? Can I just be seen for once?
Yeah, away was the prosthetics for once.
Just for once.
He was so good, though. It was, yeah.
What do you make of, this is a bit of a hot topic, but like all this stuff that's been coming out lately, you've been in the business years, does it, you know, the Weinstein thing that's opened this huge can of worms, like... Is it a shock to you? Did you see that sort of stuff when you were growing up? Or
I've never been, you know, it's unfortunately, my feeling is that this is something that's been going on, you know, it's been widespread and it's been going on a long time. So it's an important moment, I think. It's an important moment that people kind of...
Or everyone's
hopefully it becomes more... Yeah, hopefully it's this will bring about a change.
And hopefully people will... It will make people that have done it in the past conscious of, oh, shit, maybe some of them will actually go, oh, I might be one of those people, or if they've got enough self-awareness, or... I don't know. I remember hearing about it on something I worked on once and being just shocked because I thought... This was a really, like, unique moment. It was, like, a singular moment.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's, you know, that doesn't happen. Surely that's, like, what used to happen in the 70s. And clearly that thing that happened was stuff that was going on all the time. You know, that person got fired and dealt with, and I was just like, oh, God, really? That happens?
Yeah.
It's just a bit...
And it's just it's a shame that fear... You know, that fear of not being able to say anything because, well, what will be the effects on my career is it's just awful.
Well, and also the fact that you'd think anyone that wants to say something, they've got to believe that everyone else is. If they say something that they've,
well, that's the thing. If you don't have that solidarity, you can't.
How do you do it? Yeah,
and so that's why this is happening now because it's like. You have to have that. Otherwise, if you're the lone person saying, this happened to me, and everybody else remains silent, you're stuffed.
I feel like it could. I mean, some people are saying it won't change, but I feel like...
I can't say either way. I hope it does. Yeah. I feel, as Emma Thompson said in her brilliant interview recently, I feel like, you know, there's... Perhaps more women in the position, you know, in some of those
higher positions, production
positions. Will hopefully that's a shift that definitely needs to take place. And I think
let's not end it on a real down note. You have picked a guilty pleasure for us. This is something that we ask our guests. I'm not sure whether this is an out-and-out guilty pleasure.
I don't think
pleasure.
It's guilty. I mean, I could mention, you know, I love the Antiques Roadshow.
Well, that's guilty-ish, but I think you're talking to someone that 10 years ago I would have been like, what?
That's an old man. That's like a proper...
Yeah. What happens? Why do we get to a certain age and we like things about engineering or antiques or like, why is that... I would never be interested in some of the things I like now in my 20s or teens.
I saw a clip the other day of, I think they showed it on Gogglebox, of James May, some show where James May takes apart an item. Have you seen a clip of this?
I haven't seen it. I'm intrigued.
It was fantastic. I just love the fact that it could be a television program. Was the fact he takes apart various things, and one of them was an antique telephone.
Oh, my God.
He took it apart and he put it back together again on camera.
Was there a process of sort of analysing what was inside? Or
just like reveling at the, you know, this engineering.
Yeah.
He took it apart and he put it back together and made it ring at the end of the show. And I was like, I love that. I come.
Oh, my God. What, you know, I don't need to see Game of Thrones. I've got a man taking a phone apart.
I just love the fact that someone was prepared to commission that as a show. That's like...
They must be so chuffed that if that show does well, they're like, this cost us a quarter of the budget of a drama. Probably even less. And we've got viewing figures.
But I'm interested in the part of me that loves it. Yeah. Because I've got no interest in taking apart a telephone myself. But I just love the fact that I could watch him doing it.
I think sometimes it's because you don't want to watch something that's like the business you do, which is drama and fiction.
Yeah, I think you've really hit the nail upon the head. Yeah, yeah. Nail upon the head? That's a strange turn of phrase.
That's very thespian
of
you.
One has hit the nail upon one's head.
I like that. You're still in Muppet Christmas Carol territory, aren't you? That's what it is.
Dickensian. You've gone Dickensian. So.
But your other one.
So Antiques Roadshow's Guilty Pleasure. My other one is definitely not, because I don't feel guilty about this at all. I suppose it was a pleasure that I didn't expect to be. It was a discovery.
Yeah. A surprise pleasure.
A surprise pleasure introduced to me by my children, because of course that's the brilliant thing, is when your children can suddenly introduce you to stuff.
What age are your children?
They're big now. They're 25 and 21.
Oh my God! You've got proper adults.
Yeah, they're so big that when other parents are having sort of conversations about children now, you're not even considered to be one of them, because they're like, oh no, you don't know about any of this, because it's you're out of the conversation about children, because it's like, well, you don't really have them. You've got big ones. But anyway, so they introduced me to. Bob's Burgers, which is
the animated comedy, right?
Yeah. Do you know it?
I've never seen it.
Oh,
I know of it. Yeah,
so good.
Is it? Yeah,
it's so good.
Do you watch it with them?
Yes.
Yeah. Is it?
And
is
that's
it,
also
it's quite
really,
an adult sort of.
Yeah,
it's a bit edgy, right?
Yeah, but you know, we can all handle it now,
and
that's lovely in itself.
See, that's the bit.
But what's lovely about the show is it's kind of adult, but there's a. There is a beautiful naivety to it as well.
Right.
It's actually a sitcom. It's a perfect sitcom.
Yeah.
But
it's not the King of the Hill guys.
But it happens
to.
It may be. It feels like it's got a bit of that flavour to it.
Who naturally?
But it's just.
It's
a classic sitcom scenario. It's Bob and his family running a burger joint somewhere in America.
Yeah.
But the characters are just so beautifully. Yeah. Drawn.
I will check that out. I don't think that qualifies
as a guilty pleasure,
but we'll put your Antiques Roadshow. Oh,
yes.
No, the James May dismantling the phone.
I haven't even seen that, but I think I'm going to get the box and just watch
the
it.
The box.
Shall I buy the box? The James May box?
Yeah, the box set of Dismantle. That's what it's called. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to play out with your second choice of music.
Yeah.
This is... we're going to end on a bit more of an upbeat, up-tempo. This is like... Again, this is like classic soundtrack territory.
Yes.
Do you know... It's by David Shire, and it's the main theme to the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, the original. Do you know if David Shire's done other soundtracks? Are you a fan of his stuff?
I do happen to know one other soundtrack that he's done. And again, it's a film that I have seen the film a long time ago. There's a film called The Hired Hand.
Okay.
Am I getting the title right? It's a Western. It's an obscure Western. And that's a great soundtrack as well. A kind of dusty...
Yeah. Is it sort of Ennio Morricone-esque, or is it?
Yeah, it's a little more kind of. It's brilliantly Western and evocative. It's a while since I've heard it, but I know it's a class. Morricone is another one. I'm obsessed with all
he's
of his.
So good. We had Matt Holness, actor, writer, director, in, and he picked one from a movie. I can't remember what the movie was, but I'd never heard of it, and it was such a great piece of music. And you can hear how many people have like borrowed from Morricone.
Well, he's the one talking about the theme, the variations
so
on a theme. He does that
so well. This is the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Stephen, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Keep up all the good work. We'll look out for Kiri or whatever it's when it's out. And thank you for coming in.
Cheers.